Good evening and welcome to Little Atoms, the show about ideas with me, Neil Denny, and with Padre Greedy. Each episode of Little Atoms features a guest from the worlds of science, journalism, politics, academia, human rights, or the arts in conversation. Little Atoms bases itself around the ideas of the Enlightenment, things like secular humanism, free inquiry, freedom of expression, and the scientific method. Although we're just as likely to find ourselves talking about their antithesis, things like superstition, religious fundamentalism, censorship, and conspiracy theory. Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting. And our guest on this week's show was Professor Noam Chomsky. Noam Chomsky has been described as the world's greatest public intellectual. Born in 1928 in Philadelphia, Chomsky began his academic career as a young linguistics professor at MIT in the 1950s. His theory of transformational grammar suggests that the capability to form structured language is innate to the human mind. However, Chomsky first came to the general public's attention for his outspoken opposition to the Vietnam War. For more than 40 years, he has been the Academy's loudest and most consistent critic of US policies at home and abroad. Professor Chomsky has written more than 40 books, including American Power and the New Mandarins, Manufacturing Consent, Hegemony or Survival, Deterring Democracy and Failed States, and he continues to lecture frequently, as prolific a provocateur as ever. Professor Chomsky, I'm hoping you're there.
Yes, I'm here.
Hello, it's an honour to speak to you.
Thank you.
At the moment, a lot of people in Europe and I suppose around the world seeing America as emerging from something of a dark period into a bright new future with the election of President Obama. He's presented in the media over here almost in messianic terms, and now he's been in power for just over 100 days, I think it is. I'd like to know how you think it's going.
It's going about the way any rational person would have expected. The Bush administration, in particular the first term of Bush, was completely off the spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the spectrum of politics is pretty narrow, but they were just off it. I mean, they were the aggressiveness, you know, the arrogance, the brazen contempt even for allies, simply antagonized the world along with the aggressiveness of action and so on. And in fact, U.S. prestige in the world sank to its lowest point since it's ever been measured. So it was perfectly predictable that the next candidate would try to move back towards the center to be accommodating, friendly, and so on. And that's pretty much what Obama's doing. Actually, all of this brings to mind a comment about the so-called special relationship between Britain and the United States. Back in 1962, at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis, when the fate of Europe was really at stake,
mm-hmm.
Close to destruction, Washington was keeping its plans and decisions secret. It was not even informing Britain. Macmillan had to learn about it through British intelligence. He was never informed. And a high senior advisor of the Kennedy administration in internal discussion said that Britain will act as our lieutenant. The fashionable word is partner. Britain likes to hear the fashionable word, but the real word is lieutenant. Now, Bush simply told Britain and everyone else, you're our lieutenants. Obama tells them publicly, you're our partners. We really welcome you. But I'm pretty sure the internal word is the same as it was under the Kennedy administration. So yes, there's a change in rhetoric, a change in style, not very much to point to in the way of substance, but some change back towards the position of a more or less normal centrist Democrat, which is what one should have expected.
Well, you've written before the election and running up to the election that you know, Obama, as you've said, didn't have a lot of substance and he was almost the candidate that had been invented by PR, in that, you know, he was a blank slate. We've got these sort of vague terms, yes, we can, and hope and things. So, I mean, do you think that's still the case?
Yeah. In fact, as you may know, the advertising industry gives an award every year to the best marketing campaign of the year. And in 2008, they gave it to the Obama campaign.
Mm-hmm.
and executives were euphoric. You can read them quoted in the business press, like the Financial Times. They said, we've been marketing candidates like commodities ever since Reagan, and this is the best we've ever done. It's going to change the atmosphere of corporate boardrooms. Now there's going to be a new style and so on. So sure, it was a marketing campaign, and it was pretty successful. And you can see it in the popular mood. So, you know, 7 or 8 months ago, about, I think, 80% of the population believed the country is going in the wrong direction. So naturally, every candidate, including McCain, was marketed as being the candidate of change and hope. And just this week, the latest polls came out. It turns out that the population is sort of split, almost half and half, as to whether the country is going in the right direction. So they feel better about things. It's a good marketing campaign.
A lot of people here in Europe, Professor Chomsky, have been quite impressed by noises President Obama's been making, noises about the U.S. taking a lead on combating global warming, particularly, and on nuclear proliferation. Is this a message that perhaps Europeans are a bit more open to? Is this, again, something we're being sold?
Well, again, the Bush administration was off the spectrum. So the population of the United States during the Bush years was strongly in favor of strong action on global warming. In fact, the Kyoto Protocol was so popular in the United States that a majority of Bush voters in 2004 believed that he was in favor of it. That was the popular attitude. So now Obama is going closer to what had been the popular position all along, as you would expect when he's retreating for the more extreme Bush positions. And the same is true on nuclear proliferation. So the Bush administration, with its the extreme arrogance and contempt, essentially destroyed the year 2005 regular review of the Non-Proliferation Treaty and its nuclear issues. They essentially destroyed it. They said, we're not going to take part. Well, Obama's going back more towards what the Clinton position was. Yeah, we'll take part, and we will take actions that are pretty sensible. In fact, I'm in favor of them. I think that the U.S. should sign the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, should reduce nuclear weapons, should act to reduce proliferation. I wish it would do it more seriously. So to take a current crucial example, a considerable majority of Americans in the Middle East are in favor of establishing a nuclear weapons-free zone, which would include Iran, Israel, any American forces deployed there, or British forces. And that's a very sensible position. It can be accompanied by strong verification, but it's not on the agenda.
But are we looking at slightly, I think, again, looking at the wave of enthusiasm for Obama, are we looking at a different take on the idea of American exceptionalism and moral leadership as perhaps a positive thing after the, I suppose, the nadir of the Bush years?
Well, actually, that's one respect in Bush in which Bush was not off the spectrum. The idea of American exceptionalism and American moral leadership, that goes back to the 1780s. And in fact, they took it over from Britain. Britain had the same ideology as kind of providentialist ideology. You know, God has a plan for the world, and we are the agents of carrying out his mission. That was a very popular British concept. The American colonies took it over. If you go back to that time, there was a lot of internal debate about what does the victory of the colonists mean about God's mission. It was discussed in Britain. It was discussed here. And that simply continues. Obama's a little less extreme about it than some, but basically hasn't changed. I mean, that's why you have this notion in American ideology and elsewhere, too, of what's called Wilsonian idealism. You know, this is supposed to be a notion of Wilson, the great idealist, who was, in fact, quite openly saying, we're carrying out God's mission. Well, what's Wilsonian idealism? I mean, Wilson was the most interventionist president in American history up till that point. He carried out brutal, vicious interventions, which practically destroyed what was left of Haiti and a lot of the Dominican Republic and others. He instituted at home the worst repressive period in American history, his Red Scare. But he did have a notion of self-determination, but it was very qualified. Self-determination for the advanced people, like white Westerners, but not for the colonies. For the colonies, his position was that the concerns and interests of the colonizing power had to have equal status to those of the people who about whom we talk self-determination. It was a very qualified notion. But nevertheless, the concept of Wilsonian idealism remains in the doctrinal system, including scholarship. Mm-hmm. But this rarely changes. I mean, if you look at the history, it's almost always that way.
So is there any case, in your view, where American intervention can be positive and should be encouraged? And we're talking particularly about military intervention here, I suppose.
Well, it depends what you mean by intervention. Violent intervention has a very heavy burden of proof to bear. And if you look at the history, it's not a very glorious history. In fact, it's an awful history. The concept of humanitarian intervention goes back centuries, and it's almost always been a disaster, except for those who intervened. And while you can't say it can never have a benevolent effect, sometimes it does, there is a heavy burden of proof. In fact, if you look over the past post-war period, post-Second World War period, there's only two striking examples that I can think of where forceful intervention had a very significant positive humanitarian effect. One was in 1971 when India invaded East Pakistan and put an end to horrible atrocities in what became Bangladesh. And the other was in 78-79 when Vietnam invaded Cambodia and put an end to Pol Pot's atrocities just at the point where they were peaking. The worst atrocities were in 78, and Vietnam invasion put an end to it. Okay, so there are two cases which had significant positive effects, but they don't enter into the canon of discussion of humanitarian intervention for two reasons. One, they were carried out by the wrong people, them, not us. And second, the U.S. was bitterly opposed to them in both cases. I mean, in the case of India, you know, the United States practically threatened war, imposed sanctions, sent an aircraft carrier into the Bay of Bengal, and so on. In the case of Vietnam, the U.S. was outraged, supported a Chinese invasion to punish the Vietnamese for daring to put an end to Pol Pot's atrocities, and in fact, along with Britain, immediately turned to support for the Khmer Rouge. So therefore, those two instances don't count. But it's hard to think of anything like them. There are a few other cases where you can say the outcome was benevolent, whether intended or not. But any use of force carries a very high burden of proof. Now, that's been reiterated over and over again by the World Court ever since the 1940s. In 2005, I think it was, there was a high-level, 2004 maybe, there was a high-level UN commission established to discuss consider the question of what's called responsibility to protect, that is, the idea that it's legitimate to intervene in a society to protect people who are really under threat. It was a very respected Western figures were there, like Brent Scowcroft, George Bush's national security advisor, Gareth Evans, former Australian prime minister, and others. And they concluded with a careful, I think reasoned, and in my view, accurate conclusion that yes, there may be a responsibility to protect, but it must be left in the hands of the Security Council of the United Nations. What they said is that there should be no change in Article 51, that's the exception to the use of force, as you can use it in self-defense. Said there should be no change to this. It should be sustained as is, because if a responsibility to protect is handed over to states, it'll just be an excuse for aggression. Mm. It's the same conclusion the World Court reached back in the 1940s, and which the non-aligned countries overwhelmingly support. And it was then endorsed by the full General Assembly. And that seems to me correct. So yes, there's a makes sense to talk about the responsibility to protect, but it should not be left in the hands of violent, aggressive powers.
We're about halfway through the show, so we'll move on. You're listening to Little Atoms, and we're talking to Professor Noam Chomsky. One of your key works was Manufacturing Consent, and it had the thesis of the book and the documentary that came out. This idea that the mainstream media quite gently coerces the public into quite a narrow, there's a narrow range of views that are sort of acceptable. Dissenting voices are sidelined. We've recently seen, the rise of the internet, and one of the interesting things, again going back to Obama, was the it sort of presented as the use of a sort of quite grassroots activism played quite a part in the election. And I wonder what your opinion is of whether the internet itself has changed the impact of popular activism.
Oh yeah, the internet has positive and negative features. Mm-hmm. Wonderful thing it was developed. It's one of the great contributions of the state sector in the United States to the modern economy. Of course, it all comes out of the state sector for decades. Mm-hmm. But yes, I'm very glad it's there. And it is used for organizing. Obama didn't invent this.
No,
so the act, like the global justice movement, or in fact any popular movement, by now most organizing is over the internet. And Obama used the internet effectively, just as John F. Kennedy had used television effectively, to gain what's sometimes called Obama's army, a large number of supporters. But then the question is, but notice that was not his main funding, contrary to illusion. The concentration of funding came from the financial institutions. And as one would expect, and as in the past, the policies of the administration very much reflect the funders. The policies are in effect designed by the financial institution. Even centrist economists are criticizing that. Now the question is, what happens to Obama's army now that they're mobilized? Well, there's a totalitarian image and a democratic image, and the question is which wins. The position of the campaign and the media is the totalitarian conception. They say the army's out there, it's waiting to get instructions from the leader as to what to do to advance what's called brand Obama, Obama's brand. They have to advance it. Wait until they tell you which doorbells to push on what issue, and you do it. That's one conception, which is expressed openly by the campaign managers and supported by the media. There's another conception, the democratic conception, is that this army will say, we're going to get together and decide on what policies ought to be, and we're going to compel you, our representative, to follow those policies, or else we'll get rid of you. Well, that may be the popular conception, but you're not going to find much resonance for it in mainstream circles, media or anything else. But it could be a popular conception, and if so, the U.S. could move in the direction of more functioning democracy, in which the population doesn't just take orders, but in fact initiates programs.
Let's look at, you mentioned that there are good and bad sides to the internet, and one of the things that we often talk about on this show is one of the things the internet has seen is the rise of the sort of conspiracy theory, and particularly the sort of 9/11 truth movement, and this is something that you've been quite robust in criticism of yourself. I mean, let's talk about, do you think these sort of things have quite a malign influence on the perception of activism itself?
Oh, yeah. My suspicion is that the Bush administration was very pleased with the rise of the 9/11 movement because it's whatever one thinks about it, I don't think much, but whatever one thinks about it, even if you believe in it, its effect was very clear. It diverted people away from activism on serious issues. So if you're involved, if you're spending your life trying to figure out whether there was thermite in Building 7 and so on, you're not protesting the crimes of the administration.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we even have a little bit of internal evidence about this. A couple of years ago, some material was released about the proposals by a Pentagon review committee for declassification of information. And one of their proposals was that the administration should periodically release information relating to the Kennedy assassination, because that will keep, the sort of those who are claiming it was a government conspiracy. It'll keep them engaged,
keep them occupied,
running on this wild goose chase, and they won't be asking questions and asking for material on things we'd rather keep secret. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't be surprised if there's the same reasoning in the administration on this. That's clearly its effect. And it's true, as you said, that the Internet is a very effective cult generator. That's one of its, not just this, but other things. I mean, you and I could start a cult suppose we decided that Tony Blair is trying to poison the world's water. You could put something up saying, you know, out in my backyard I saw people from the Labor Party poisoning the pipes, and somebody else will say, oh yeah, I saw that too, and pretty soon you have a big conspiracy going. You big find bits and pieces of factoids that bolster it. And like other cults, it'll be self-generating and protected.
We should definitely do that. It's a good idea. Where does this impulse come from to believe this stuff? Because where does it come from? Yeah.
I think it's pretty easy to understand. I mean, where did support for Nazism come from in Germany? Look, I mean, Germany was the most civilized country in the world in the 1920s. It was the peak of Western civilization. The sciences, the arts, literature, it was the model of democracy. You know, a couple of years later, it was the depths of barbarism. And we know what happened. There were a large number of people who were very disillusioned. Things were happening to them that they didn't understand. I'm a decent person, but my life is being destroyed. Somebody must be doing it. It can't be me, because I'm working hard. I'm a honest person. So something must be happening from the outside that's doing this to me. And Nazi propaganda identified it. You know, it's the Jews, the Bolsheviks. Okay, that gives an answer. And people can sort of organize, give an interpretation of the oppression in their lives on the basis of this conspiracy. And we know what happened in Germany. And that can happen elsewhere. Mm-hmm. I don't know about England, but if you listen to talk radio in the United States, which is all taken over by the ultra-right, it's full of ideas like this. I mean, here we are, hardworking, Christian, honest Americans, white Americans, and look what's happening to our lives. For 30 years, our real wages have stagnated or declined. Benefits have declined. Working hours have gone up. Now, I lost my job and my home. Why is this happening to me? Well, it's got to be somebody. Their line is it's the rich liberals who own Wall Street and own the government and have contempt for us ordinary people, what are called the flyby people. They want to give everything away to gays and illegal immigrants, and meanwhile us, the people between the two coasts, they have only contempt for us. Well, that's an appealing message, and it has a unpleasant resemblance to the late Weimar Republic, unfortunately, and I wouldn't discount it. So I think it is easy to understand conspiracy theories. I mean, the same with the 9/11 conspiracy. I mean, look what's happening to us and what's happening to the world. Some bad people must have done it, and there's plenty of facts that you can point to that show, yeah, they're bad people, they're doing bad things, so why shouldn't they have blown up the World Trade Center? I mean, they're kind of elementary flaws in the theory. So if they did blow up the World Trade Center because they wanted to invade Iraq, why did they blame it on Saudis and not Iraqis? So you have to make some complicated story about that. But that's typical of kind of, I hate to use the word because they're nice people, but what amount to cults?
It's a perfect place to end it on. We're unfortunately out of time. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you. So thank you very much for agreeing to speak to us today, Professor Chomsky.
Okay, good to talk to you. Yeah.